Today's Teisho will be on Case 11 in the Book of Serenity. Case 11 is entitled Yunmen's Two Sicknesses. Introduction. A bodiless man suffers illness. A handless man compounds medicine. A mouthless man ingests it. A senseless man is well. But tell me, how do you treat a mortal disease? Case. Great Master Yunmen said, when the light does not penetrate freely, there are two kinds of sickness. One is when all places are not clear and there is something before you. Having penetrated the emptiness of all things, subtly it seems like there is something. This too is the light not penetrating freely. Also, the Dharma body has two kinds of sickness. One, when you manage to reach the Dharma body, but because of your clinging to Dharma, because your clinging to Dharma is not forgotten, your sense of self still remains, and you fall into the realm of the Dharma body. Even if you can pass through, if you let go, that won't do. Examining carefully to think, what breath is there? This too is sickness. The dense web of myriad forms is so precipitous. Passing through location blocks the eyes. Sweeping out his garden, who has the strength? Hidden in a person's heart, it naturally produces feelings. A boat crosses a rustic ford, wet with autumn's aquamarine. Sailing into the reed flowers, shining on the snow, bright. With a bolt of silk, an old fisherman takes it to the market. Floating in the wind, a single leaf travels on the waves. Thank you for coming to practice Zen this morning. I have been back in the United States now for about a week. One of our members, Mary, some of you may know her, she's actually in France right now. But she and her husband Barry have an apartment in France. And it's in a beautiful location, about 6 or 7 blocks from the Arc de Triomphe. It's a small, charming apartment in what's called the 17th arrondissement. It's a 17th district. And it's quite beautiful. In fact, it's like Walt Disney, a Walt Disney version of Paris. So Mary asked me if I would like to stay in her apartment while she was in Turkey. And she asked me this last summer, and I said, no, I couldn't accept. And then she asked me this spring, and I thought, no, I couldn't accept. And then I thought, well, why don't I accept? So I accepted. And my wife, Barbara, and I went to Paris, which we've never been to. And we stayed for 2 weeks. And it was a lovely apartment to stay in. And it has a kitchen, you know, and so on. So we ate out a number of times, but we didn't eat out all the time, and we didn't have to stay in an expensive hotel. So it was really fantastic. And we walked everywhere. They have a great public transportation system. And I was really studying the French, you know, because the more I was in Paris, the more I admired the French. I used to be able to read French pretty comfortably and speak it decently. But I've gotten really rusty over the years. But I had remembered reading people like Camus, Albert Camus, and some famous French writers, poets. And I sort of liked French culture. But being on the ground in Paris was really fascinating because I think they have a really wonderful, wonderful culture. I get up very early in the morning, and usually I meditate in the morning, and if I have time, I go for a jog. And I usually go for a jog around, say, 6:30 in the morning, maybe 7. And when I go out of the house, people are already leaving their homes in my neighborhood, and they're all going off to work. And by like 8 o'clock, 8:30, the street is really, the main arteries around my house are really dense with traffic, thick with traffic. And people are really getting to work early. I would say 8:30 at the latest. And, you know, when I come back from my jog, it's around that time, I take a shower, and then I leave for work, and I'm only 20 minutes from my workplace, so it's really a nice deal. But when I'm going on the roads, it's almost empty, because everybody's already left for work. And then, as you know, I come home pretty late at night, so I don't get home till almost 10 o'clock. But the thing that I noticed in France was I got up, I did my meditation, I went for a jog, and I was waiting for all these people to come out at like 7:30, with their business clothes on and bustling and hustling around. Nothing. Really, people in France start work later than we do. My impression is they start work around 10 o'clock. And I noticed too that they go to bed later, you know, like at 10 o'clock at night, people are having dinner. Yeah, this explains why they don't get up at 7 in the morning. You know, at 10 o'clock at night, if you're out on a main artery, all the restaurants are open. They have all these tables on the street, and people are the huge numbers of people, and they're all talking in the very convivial, eating meals late at night. And somebody I was talking to told me that the way it works is that the French get to work a little later than we do, and then they might close. Some of the smaller businesses close in the afternoon a little bit, a couple hours to even 3 hours, and then they reopen, and then they close later at night. So it's more of a Mediterranean clock. And I have to say, I thought it was great. I thought, if you're in New York, you really feel the pressure. You know, you feel it. You know, if you're down in Manhattan, it's not just that the streets are packed. They're packed in Paris too, but the way people move is almost like demons are haunting them. You know, I like New York, by the way. In fact, I love New York. But there's a kind of frenzy or a kind of, you know, a real frenzy to New York. People seem like they're pushing hard a lot of the time. I don't mean they don't go to lunch and have long lunches, because they do. But there's something different. The pace, my impression is that the pace in France is different. You know, they make, you know, this could be a romantic projection, but they seem to make more time for things. You know, they seem to take things a little more slowly. And they seem to make more time for lunch, you know, for example. And I'm told they have pretty serious lunches, you know. When I was staying there, the place we were staying in, the apartment, Mary's apartment, doesn't have internet connectivity. So Mary told me the place to get free Wi-Fi, or as the French call it, free Wi-Fi, is in McDonald's. It's how McDonald's is luring people in. So I, who never eat at McDonald's, went to McDonald's every day with my computer, my laptop, and I would order an espresso, and the person would say, "Just an espresso?" And I'd say, "Yes, only an espresso, thank you." And I'd take my espresso and I'd go upstairs and get online. And I was so happy to notice that the McDonald's had hardly any people in it. So I think that the McDonald's lifestyle has not really penetrated into France, you know. In the neighborhood where we were staying, there was a market open every day, and the place was packed. People would go. There was there is like a ShopRite. It's called Carrefour, But there was a Carrefour down the street. But all the same, people use the market. And I just thought the pace of life was really different, really, really quite pleasant. You know, the French, I think, really have discovered a way of life that's very, it may change, you know, everything changes, but I think somehow they've worked out a way of life that is really very mature, very sophisticated, and it's quite beautiful. You know, I'm a big fan of the arts, and in Paris, even today, is like the arts are everything. You know, I mean, the rock stars of France are still artists, really. You know, somebody like Monet is still just absolutely worshipped, and it's so clear the French work hard, and at least the Parisians work hard to make their city beautiful. You know, the buildings are quite beautiful in themselves, and then, you know, there's all these trees on the street, and they're meticulously kept up. You know, they're pruned meticulously, and they're all quite cared for. In a way that, you know, is not always the case here in the United States. So, you know, it sounds like I'm about to move to Paris, you know. It's not quite true, but I really was impressed by the French. And I kept thinking, how have they done this, you know? How have they done this? How have they, you know, there were so many things that I liked. For example, when I did go out for a jog, even though people weren't going off to work, I noticed that a lot of women were taking their babies to the central location. And when I asked what it was, it turns out it's childcare. The French have free government-sponsored childcare. So working women can take their children to a place, and by the way, the childcare centers, they're called creches, like a manger. They're really nice places, and they have lovely playgrounds for kids, and you have professionals, people who actually who are like trained professionals managing, taking care of the kids during the day. And I saw all these women who are obviously working women dropping their kids off. And then I presume they would go to work. And then if I were around in the afternoon, I sometimes saw them taking their kids, you know, checking the kids in and checking the kids out. And I thought that is just wonderful. You know, it's so hard to take care of children here. You have to stay home, or you have to take your child to child care that you have to pay for, a lot of money. A friend of mine, when she was taking her children to child care, she said she spent almost her whole income just on the child care for her kids. So, you know, the French have that going for them, you know. They have a much more, I think, caring society. And also they have, free education, basically, essentially, so you don't have to take massive student loans. Amazing, right? You know, medical care, if you get sick, they have universal medical coverage. And so, you know, with all of these things, you would expect people to be happy. And indeed, my impression is they seem very happy. You know, lots of people warned me that the Parisians were rude and impolite, but I didn't find that to be the case at all. They seemed to be very jovial and convivial people, and they were uniformly helpful. You know, when I would ask them something in French, and they could usually detect that French wasn't my language, and then they would start speaking in very good English and give me what I needed to know. And I kept thinking, what's their secret? You know, there's something about this way of life which is so successful. It was like a mystery to me. You know, how have they done this? You know, because you know, you can go to lots of places in the United States that are pretty, but, you know, I really felt that this was an accomplished way of life. You know, I have felt that way also in my encounters with Japanese culture. You know, I have known Japanese people, sometimes Zen priests and other people like that, who really have a way of life that's really accomplished. It's beautiful, it's open, it's intelligent, and it's it's mature somehow, you know. I've met Japanese people who just have really developed like an art of living that's very accomplished, very beautiful. You know, my first teacher was like that. He was very mature person. You know, one time we were all trying to get something done. We had a big task ahead of us. It was a big job. We were going to have an event in our community, and we were all racing around, getting really tired and sort of grouchy. And Genki Roshi stopped us all and made us sit down and have some lunch. And he was laughing. He said, "You know, nothing can be accomplished if you're in that state of mind. You know, you have to be calm. You have to be relaxed. If you're trying too hard, you know, you make yourself, you create resistance. You know." And I thought of that when I was in France, because, you know, the French are they have an art of living. It's not like, on the surface, it's not like the Japanese way of life. You know, today, Japanese people work themselves to death, actually, you know, really. I mean, Japanese people are really hard on themselves, you know. But I think in the old times, Japanese people had a real art of living. I think the Chinese people had a real art of living. If you read about pre-modern China, there was a lot of wisdom in the everyday life of people. You know, they understood that the purpose of living is to be alive, right? It's to enjoy life. It's to savor life. And you know, things like the art of having tea in Chinese culture is part of this cultivation of our lives, of having a beautiful life, having a happy life, having an intelligent life, you know, living skillfully, artfully. And it was so clear that the French have done this too, you know, in their own way. You know, they're not Zen practitioners. They seem to have worked out this way of life that's very aware and quite wonderful, you know. I mean, it's own. I have to say that the women of Paris are almost all beautiful, you know. Well, maybe not, but it seemed that way, you know, because everybody dresses absolutely carefully, you know. I walked around on the streets, even in museums, and women would go by and they were so beautifully dressed, not necessarily ostentatiously dressed, but so they it was like people try to be artistic in the way they dress, you know. And again, that reminded me of the Japanese, you know. In old times, Japanese people put a lot of emphasis on you know, like a kimono. Wearing a kimono was supposed to be you don't just wear clothes are supposed to be artfully worn, you know. And different civilization, but again, this, you know, especially I noticed the women, you know, they don't wear a lot of jewelry, they don't, you know, but what they wear is very tasteful. It's like they've been studying fashion, I guess. You know, Paris is the capital of fashion, and again, I saw women with just beautiful clothes, and they you know, took it seriously. I just thought, this is so interesting, you know. Somebody had warned me not to wear sneakers, big white American sneakers, so I didn't. I wore a pair of black sneakers and jeans. The uniform in Paris for casual men is a jeans, polo shirt, and black sneakers. And if I wore that, people thought I was French, I think, you know. So I was wearing that around, I just really liked Paris, as you can tell. But there was something, there was like a mystery about it. And what I think it is, you know, what I think it is that they don't expect too much of life, you know? They don't expect too much of life. I really think that's it, you know? I think maybe that's the secret of the universe, you know? one of the days, how shall I put it? You know, the French had a very religious civilization, you know, for a long time. And people were really unhappy, you know, during the Middle Ages. People were poor, and you had like Louis the 14th, who built Versailles, this incredible palace. You know, every dollar in France was used to build this gigantic palace, which is really over the top in every possible way. And I kept thinking to myself, all these people were living miserable lives so that Louis the 14th could build this sumptuous palace. Every square inch is high art, you know. And the French had a revolution, and they overthrew their aristocrats. And they stopped being, like, religious. They just stopped, you know. And today, you know, like 2 or 3% of French people go to church. And I think that their attitude, they tried to create a society that was based on reason. For a couple hundred years, they tried to create the society built on reason. And I think that didn't work out either, you know. I think they kind of gave up on that. And then I think they began to say, okay, well, what's life about? And I think they just began to be happy to be alive, you know. So I think they started out as a very religious civilization with these extraordinary high ideals. And then they threw off their religion, chopped off the head of the king and so on. And then they tried to create this civilization based on pure reason. But I think it made them sick, you know, made them unhappy. And then, you know, they turned to, like, art. They turned to experience, a beautiful life. And so today I think the French, you know, if you say, what are their ideals? I don't think they really have, like, very lofty ideals, you know. I think they just want to have a nice life. And I think they cultivate living in the moment, you know. This is a crazy theory, and it might be totally wrong. And if you're French, or you know somebody who's French, they might tell you that I'm full of hot air, and it wouldn't be the first time, of course. But I think there's something to this, that, you know, like, mature cultures don't look for the big answers, you know. They just want to be in the moment and be present in a way that's fulfilling, that's open, intelligent, compassionate. And everywhere around me, I looked at people who probably don't have, you know, big ideals, you know, but who are just trying to be, to live well. And I think that's kind of like the secret of France, you know. I don't think we're like that. I mean, I think Americans are very Puritan. You know, we're very Puritan still. In fact, there was an article in the New York Times, I don't know if you saw it, but it was saying that, it says that some sociologists were studying, and psychologists were studying Americans, and they said many basic Puritan ideas are still around, you know. So Americans still work to achieve salvation, you know, interestingly enough. That don't ask me how they proved it, but they did. But the thing is, you know, we're always sort of like reaching for something. We're always trying to achieve like a big goal. I think that's very much part of our national psychology. And I think we're a little suspicious of giving up on that. You know, I mean, America was founded by people who had big ideas. You know, America was going to transform the world. And basically, we had this idea of absolute freedom, and so on and so on. And I think we're constantly trying to reach, the unreachable star. You know that song? When I was growing up, everybody loved that song. To reach the unreachable star. You know, I did that pretty well. But you know, I don't think the French are trying to reach the unreachable star or right the unrightable wrong, you know. I think they're just trying to live well in the moment. I think that's really very close to Zen wisdom. You know, it's important to try to do the right thing. It's important to try to leave the world a little better than you found it, you know. But, you know, I think there's really a great wisdom in the moment, in trying to be present in the moment without expecting too much. Yeah? And I think that's very hard for us as a people because of our history. And I think it's very hard for us because of our social life, you know. So, you know, I came home the other night and my wife is watching the Olympics. You know, she's glued to the television watching the Olympics. And every day I open the newspaper and it has our tally of medals. And of course, America and China are in this rivalry. So like on Thursday, China was ahead, and then on Friday, America was ahead, and then Saturday, I think China's back up, and it's like a tussle of the giants. And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be nice just to live in a country where, you know, basically it didn't matter if we came in first or second or third, you know, it's not the spirit of the Olympics, of course, to just show up and have a good time. You're supposed to get a gold medal. But I wish we had a little bit more of that spirit where it's just like, you know, you just want to do a decent showing. Just do a decent showing, you know. Somebody doesn't get a medal, you know, it's okay. You know, just getting to the Olympics is quite an achievement. I think there's something about our national culture which says, you know, you really have to be first. You really have to be first. If China gets the most medals, I think we're going to be like angry about it on some deep level, right? We're going to be jealous. It's like we should be. You hear this all the time. People say, you know, we're number one, you know, and then other people say we're not number one anymore, but they wish we were. And I'm not sure it's so important to be number one. You know, if you look at this, the countries that are the happiest places in the world. And they've done studies, you know, of countries in their life satisfaction. They're not grindingly poor places. They're places like Denmark or Norway or Bhutan. And there's a couple countries in Latin America, believe it or not, that have very high rates of life satisfaction. And they're like little countries in Latin America that nobody really cares too much about, right? But people have a good life. You know, you don't really think of the Danes as being powerful and important, but apparently they're very happy, you know. So I think almost the greatness, this desire for greatness, is kind of a drug, or is like a disease, like a sickness. You know, to want to be number one, I think, as a country, is really like a curse. Why don't we not worry about being number one? Let's just worry about being a good place to live. You know, let's just have childcare. Let's just have free medical care. You know, it sounds like I'm running for office, but I couldn't help but think about these differences culturally. You know, my wife and I were in Paris on Bastille Day, which is their 4th of July. And we went out to the street to see the whole thing. We went to the Arc de Triomphe, and I pronounced that is the result of 5 years of French in high school, that pronunciation. We went out to the Arc de Triomphe to see the planes fly over, and they flew over in formation, and they had red, white, and blue exhaust, and maybe a million people were out on the street. And then the tanks went by, and all this military equipment went by. And the person standing next to me, who was an American, said to me, he said, "It's kind of sad, isn't it, to see a military display by a fourth-rate power?" And I swear somebody said that to me. And I thought, who cares, you know? It's Paris, you know? I like being a fourth-rate power. I think that was an American attitude, right? You have to be first. Now, I actually think this trickles down to our feelings about ourselves, you know. I feel that we, I think in American life there's a lot of jealousy and a lot of self-dislike, you know. So I think that we feel unlovable and unloved. And I think we look around at other people and we feel they are more loved, you know. And I think that creates a lot of unhappiness, if I may say so. I think it's hard for us to be content with ourselves. You know, it's hard for me. It's hard for all of us, and I think it's part of this culture that we live in, you know. You know, I have a friend of mine who has published 5 books. You know, 5 books. And I have to say, I only have 2. You know, I got 1 to get to be tenured at Rutgers, and if I didn't write that book, I would be fired, so I had to write that book. And then there was another book I wrote to become a full professor. It wasn't my only reason, but it was a part of the reason. And, you know, I look around and I have all these friends who have written, you know, it's like they're writing they're book machines, right? They write. So my friend has 5 books. And they're, you know, all very prestigious presses, University of California, University of Yale. And you know, I was talking to him once and he just, you know, he was so down and he was so depressed. I don't know if he was clinically depressed, but he was really sad because, you know, somebody else had gotten the research award at Rutgers. They give a big award every year to somebody who's the best researcher. And he hadn't gotten it, and he felt terrible, right? And all I could say was, you know, everybody admires you, you know? Everybody admires you. You know, you have 5 books. You know, you're the authority on such and such in the world, you know? Why are you making yourself so unhappy, you know? But, I mean, I do it too. But, When we do that kind of thing, when we compare ourselves to others, you know, we're making ourselves unhappy artificially, and we're not living skillfully, you know. So you know, I think do I think people in France are jealous of each other? Yes, of course. I didn't mean to suggest they are not jealous or they're not. But I think they have a different style. I think that they're a little bit more comfortable with not expecting too much of life, you know? Years ago I was reading this this child psychologist named Winnicott, D.W. Winnicott. And he had this theory, he was writing mostly to women who had babies. And he had this theory, he called it the good enough mother. Isn't that great? Because, you know, when my sister had her kids, my sister told me that when she had her two children, she felt she made a mistake every day, you know, and it drove her crazy because my sister is like a nurse practitioner. She, you know, wants to get the right medicine to the right person. And she said, I feel like I'm making mistakes all the time with my children. And so she's a little bit of a perfectionist, and so I recommended Winnicott, you know, and indeed Winnicott helped, because Winnicott has this idea of the good enough mother. You know, he kind of says, trust yourself, you know, trust your instincts. And, you know, you don't have to be a perfect mother, you just have to be a good enough mother. I think that's great, you know. You don't have to win the Rutgers Research Award. You just have to be a good enough professor, you know? I think that's so important, you know? That's I think, a more mature civilization, right? I don't know if you like painting, but I myself love painting, and like so many people, I love the Impressionists. So when I was in Paris, I went to the Musée d'Orsay to see the wonderful collection of Impressionists, and I also went to the Orangerie to see Monet's painting. And, you know, I have always thought Monet was, he's probably my favorite painter. My wife and I went out to his house in Giverny, which is outside of Paris. And it's beautiful. You know, he bought some property out in the country after he became a fairly famous painter. And he has there's a stream that runs through his property, and the stream divides in two branches, and there's a little island. And he's created this absolutely magical garden with beautiful willow trees and a Chinese bridge, you know, or Japanese bridge, you know, it's a beautiful place, you know. And you know, I have always thought Monet was a great artist, and his garden was wonderful. And then I read this story about Monet that was so interesting. Because by the time Monet built his house, he was like a rock star. He was the great artist of France. But about 35 years earlier, he tried to commit suicide. Isn't that interesting? He was the struggling artist. His mistress and model became pregnant, and he had no money, and then she had a baby, and they were living under terrible conditions. And he couldn't get arrested. You know, his paintings, he couldn't get anybody to pay attention to his paintings. And so one day, Monet went out and threw himself in the Seine. And he said he was really ready to die. He jumped in the water, and he said when he hit that cold water, he realized, wait, I want to live, you know. So he didn't commit suicide. He went on to paint this beautiful painting called Impression. It's the start of Impressionism, right? Like, it wasn't immediately after getting out of the water, but he did this beautiful painting that launched Impressionism, and of course started this whole movement. But, you know, he had a dark moment when, I think, you know, you could say he just realized, look, my standards are too high. You know, I think people commit suicide sometimes because their standards are too high. You know, maybe, I think Monet kind of said, okay, maybe I won't be the greatest painter of all time, I'll be a good enough painter. But that would be great, right? Just to be a good enough painter, you know, that's great. That's good enough. And you know, I think when Monet wasn't trying to be a great painter, he became a great painter. Just go figure. But I think he wasn't trying anymore to be a great painter. He was just trying to paint. He just doing something that made him feel alive and good about life. When we do things because we are trying to be approved of, that is not necessarily a good motive. A better motive is doing it because it makes us feel alive. And usually, I think this was Genki Roshi's point, you know, when we were all scrambling around, you know, it's like, you know, sometimes we do things out of insecurity and out of our own sense of being not adequate. And we're trying to be approved of. We're trying to be good. We're trying to be excellent. You know, I guess you could say. And maybe it's okay to just be good enough. Just to be a good enough human being. You know, it's good enough. So anyway, I think the secret of France is that people have a lot of people are good enough people. You know, they want to be good, but they don't necessarily want to be great, and I think it makes life better. You know, I think reaching for the unreachable star makes you sick, in my opinion. At least, you know, you should always take everything I say with a big grain of salt. But I kind of think that's the Zen style. It is not to try too hard, you know, but to just to be good enough. Now, you know, if you go to a Zen temple in Japan, that won't be the style. You know, the style there is to kill yourself, right? But I'm not. This is going to sound like kind of a arrogant thing to say, but I don't think the Japanese always understand Zen. I think that the Japanese culture is very, very, very compulsive and self-disciplining. And I don't think Zen was like that in China. You know, there was a great story, I'm sure you're familiar with, about a monk who came to a temple and he was sitting day and night. And the Roshi there, the Sifu, saw him sitting day and night. He wouldn't even take breaks. He would just sit. And the Sifu, or the Roshi, came in one day and sat next to him with a roof tile in his hand and started polishing the roof tile. And this monk looks over and he sees the teacher sitting next to him, which is unusual in itself. And the guy's polishing the roof tile, right? And finally the monk says, okay, I know he's trying to teach me something. So he says, what are you doing? The teacher said, I'm polishing this roof tile so it can become a mirror. And the student says, well, it'll never become a mirror, it's no matter how much you polish it, unless it's already a mirror, right? Unless it's already shiny, already bright. And the teacher says, exactly, you know, exactly. So, you know, your mind is already bright. You just be with the brightness. You know, you're trying too hard. I think in China the Zen style wasn't like the Japanese style. I just don't believe it. You know, if you come out of Chinese, you look at Chinese culture, you know, the Taoist ideal of wu wei, no effort. That doesn't mean you don't sit, but it means you don't try too hard. You be a good enough Zen student. See, that's a more honest way to practice. It's honest. It's less grasping and desperate. Just good enough. You know, it doesn't have to be perfect. That's ego. Good enough is a little less ego, right? Just good enough. Am I saying the French have no ego? No, they have giant egos. That's clear. But you know, they're not giant egos. They're just little egos. You know, they kind of know it. It's like, they know it, you know? Good enough. Of course, everything I say about France could be my own fantasy, right? So I've turned the French into Zen practitioners in my mind. But I still think I'm onto something. There's something about their civilization. You know, they chopped the head off their king, and so they don't have a king. And they really got rid of religion. And so they're left with life. You know, and their heroes are these artists who were talking about how to live a good life. You know, when I was in the Musée d'Orsay, the room that had the Impressionists in it, every other room in the museum had people in it. But when you get to the one, the fourth floor that has all the Impressionists, it's wall-to-wall people. You know, it never fails. You know, there were thousands of people in there. You know, everybody loves that, you know, the phrase, joie de vivre, that joy of living, right? Joy of living. In this koan that I just read is sounds very technical. It says, when the light does not penetrate freely, there are two kinds of sicknesses. So, you know, when you sit sometimes and you give up on the idea that anything is going to be accomplished, sometimes you have a really nice sit. I don't know if you've noticed that, but when you give up, and you just are content to sit, sometimes you have you feel good. You feel maybe happy and open, and your mind is a little bright if you observe it, you know. There's a kind of brightness in your mind. And this is the mind that's good enough mind. And really there's no obstacles in this state, because anything that comes by is acceptable, right? Is okay. This is a non-judging mind, right? And as soon as something happens that that causes us to feel disturbed, right? Disturbed, like troubled, angry, fearful, inferior, jealous. As soon as something like that happens, you know, we fall, right? This is like a fall out of paradise, right? And now we're back into the struggle, you know, the struggle. And this is a kind of sickness, right? I mean, every once in a while we realize that life is just life. You know, we don't, our aspirations stop being so great, our expectations stop being so great. And we're, you know, sitting is all about just being present with the moment. And we don't really expect too much of the moment when we're sitting well. And anything that comes by is okay. This is a Zen ideal. This is the Zen ideal. This is the non-discriminating mind, non-dualistic awareness. But sometimes something arises that causes that flowing intelligence to be halted or arrested. And then we're caught in a turmoil, and there's tension and stress or fear or anger. Now we're back in the mess, right? You know, and you know, we have to come back to the breath, and you know, have to do a lot of work to get through that. You have to work through that, you know. You keep coming back to your breath, and it troubles you, and it troubles you. At some point, you know, it stops troubling you because your mind has gotten a little bigger. You know, things have happened to me in my life. When I look back at them, I can't believe I was upset about it, you know. My teacher, Genki Roshi, was a ceramicist. He made beautiful ceramics. And tea bowls, especially beautiful tea bowls. And Genki Roshi made a tea bowl for me that was beautiful. He made a tea bowl for each person in the Zendo. And, you know, Genki Roshi was like my hero. And so my hero made a tea bowl for me. You know, and each tea bowl, you know, when he gave me that bowl, I was just like so honored. And I felt so noticed, you know. I felt, oh, you know, I'm alive. That's great, you know. And I wanted, you know. So anyway, that tea bowl was like Genki saying, you know, we have a bond, you know. And so anyway, at the end of the training season, we had a little break in the training season. It was like a month or two when Genki went to Japan, and there was no sitting. And we were all supposed to take our cushions home and not leave them at the Zendo, and our bowl. And I took them home and I put the bowl on a shelf, and while I was showing somebody the bowl, it was like it leapt out of my hands. It was astounding, right? Because I was being so careful. And it was just like a demon took it out of my hands, right? You know, and it just sort of leapt out of my hands and fell on the floor, and it broke. And I was just so distressed. You know, that bothered me so much. I went all over Seattle to ceramics people trying to find out who could repair this bowl. And they kept telling me what I already knew was true, which is, you know, you could glue it, but it's not going to work. And I said, well, isn't there somewhere you could refire it? Or, you know, I mean, I was just out of my mind. This meant so much to me. It was like my friendship with my teacher was broken. You know, it was it was like something I deeply valued. My chance of being respected or loved by my teacher had been broken or was placed at risk. And so I went all over town and I tried to find, I couldn't sleep. This bothered me so much, right? And I thought, if I go to tell him that I have broken his bowl, you know, he will be heartbroken that I have been so careless with his attention and his love. And I told him the bowl broke, and he said, just a minute. And he went down into the basement, which was his. So he came up with another ball and handed it. That really happened. End of story. Right? But oh, I made that so big, right? I made that so big. I couldn't sleep. But we have those kinds of issues that we have to sit with. It's so hard, it's so hard, right? Sometimes just to be good enough, just a good enough life. You know, we didn't really make ourselves sick, but we get sick sometimes. And we have to do some sitting, and after a while we realize it's okay. You know, I didn't get the Scholar of the Year award, but that's okay. You know, I don't have 5 books, that's okay. It's okay. You know, what was I, you know, people with 5 books just look enviously at people with 10 books, you know. That's the human way. There's got to be a better way than that, right? Yunmen's 2 sicknesses. A bodiless man suffers illness. A handless man compounds medicine, makes medicine. A mouthless man ingests it, a senseless man is well. But tell me, how do you treat mortal disease? Mortal disease is what I went through over the teacup. Great Master Yunmen said, when the light does not penetrate freely, there are 2 kinds of sickness. One is when all places are not clear and there is something before you. In other words, something is blocking you. Having penetrated the emptiness of all things, subtly it seems like there is something. This too is the light of not penetrating freely. So, you know, you can be in deep mushin, and, you know, basically you can feel like you've finally achieved liberation, and then the next day something happens that puts you back into that sickness, you know. So you just have to keep sitting. Even when you pass through, if you let go, that won't do. Examining carefully, even when you think, what breath is there? That too is sickness. You know, so even working on our problems is a kind of sickness. We need to, I guess, use sickness to cure our sickness. At some point, we just let it all go, and the moment is really quite wonderful, just as it is. The dense web of myriad forms is so precipitous. Passing through beyond location blocks the eyes. Sweeping out his garden, who has the strength? Hidden in a person's heart, it naturally produces feelings. A boat crosses a rustic ford, wet with autumn's aquamarine. Sailing into the reed flowers, shining on the snow, bright. With a bolt of silk, an old fisherman takes it to the market. Floating in the wind, a single leaf travels on the waves.